Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Switching gears, I'm going to talk with you about swimming now. It's been around for a very long time, maybe 10,000 years, as a matter of fact. And our next guest, Howard Means, is the author or co-author of 10 books, by the way, including 67 Shots, Kent State, and the End of American Innocence. His new book is called Splash, 10,000 Years of Swimming. So, are you a fan of swimming? Do you swim for exercise? What questions do you have about its history? It's got fascinating history, I can tell you that for sure. Join the conversation. Give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Howard Means, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me, Larry. I appreciate it.
Well, I really enjoyed your book. Swimming, it's been a big part of your life.
It's been a major part of my life. And I've been writing books for a long time, and I've been saving string on this since the early 90s, I finally realized. You know, they always say, write a book about what you know. And I think I know something about it, so I finally got around to it, and I'm really happy with the result.
Yeah, you're one of those round-shouldered guys, huh?
Am I ever. I tell the story in the book. In fact, I went to a funeral service for my old college coach, a guy named Ralph Law down at University of Virginia. And I didn't know a person who walked in. There were 500 people must have walked in. He'd been around there a long time. But I could pick out every swimmer in the crowd because they were all as round-shouldered as I was as they came in.
And you actually even describe how that happens.
I know. It's interesting, isn't it? I'd always wondered about it. And a friend of mine actually was the team orthopod for University of North Carolina at Wilmington. And he explained it. Just you build up the muscles on your, because the swimmers have a particular look to them. They have this sort of muscular chest and the front end of their chest, and it just pulls everything forward. And I'm finding now that I'm getting on in years that it is a problem, and I had to do what he suggested, and that's develop my back muscles to pull the shoulders back a little bit, because everything sort of gets pinched up in the what's called the acromion, which is more than anybody wants to know. But it's up around the ball joint of the shoulder.
Oh, man. Well, and you were able to pick out every swimmer in that in the bunch.
Every serious one. It's pretty obvious, I can tell you.
Oh, man. So
I'd love to watch an Olympic team get off the airplane. And, you know, everybody was there, the basketball players, the runners, everybody else. You could pick them out one by one, I think, as they came off the swimmer, 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 swimmer.
Well, let's get back in history here a little bit. There was a cave with a picture of swimmers, and that cave was dated at around 8,000 years ago.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating? I just love opening the book with that cave, and it's in the southwest Egyptian desert near the border with Libya and Chad, the corner, I should say. And it is now officially, by the aridity index, the driest spot on planet Earth. It's also the home of the oldest known cave paintings, pictographs as they're known, of swimmers. And you start with that mystery, and that's sort of a mystery I started with. And so why? And then I started exploring that, and the answer is that because 12,000 years ago, it's pretty evident that the Earth wobbled on its axis a little bit. Just a little bit, but it was enough to bring all the rains we associate with the Congo and that area down there north into the Sahara, and it's known officially as the African humid period. But what it means is that there were lakes, there were river systems, and everything what are now is just, you know, nothing but sand. And that said to me, okay, swimming's about more than swimming. I mean, swimming is an index of all sorts of things, of climate change, of fashion changes, of societal changes, the way people gather in public settings and all that sort of stuff. And so it said to me, wow, there's a lot I can write about here.
Yeah, there definitely is.
You might have seen, I write about everything in the book.
It's fascinating stuff. I mean, You even read at one earlier in maybe chapter two or three, I forget now. Yeah. Swimming is even referenced in the book of Isaiah.
In the book of Isaiah, not very attractively, I got to say.
No.
They're talking about the Moabs and how that though they move their hands in the though they move their hands like swimmers in the water, they're being trod down in a dung pit at the moment, and so it's not the best recommendation for swimming. But somebody told me also that swimming dies out in the Middle Ages; it absolutely disappears in Europe. And part of that was because of the biblical reference that associated swimming with the Moabs and with dung pits. So it's, you know, it's interesting how all this stuff plays forward.
But there was a golden age. The classical period.
The Greeks and the Romans, yeah. Plato, a pretty good source, said that a man can't be considered educated unless he could read, write, or swim. And the Romans felt the same way, too. Well, the Romans took a while to get to it. But part of it, of course, and the Egyptians, these were Mediterranean civilizations. It made sense for them to swim, to be active in the water. It also had military value because, you know, all wars were, well, not all wars, but a lot of wars were naval wars in Greece, particularly the Peloponnesians and all the islands around there. And so there are these wonderful accounts of swimming in warfare, but also swimming in peacetime. People just love to get in the water and swim. And, of course, they swam buck naked. And if you've ever been in the Caribbean or the Aegean Sea, it's very tempting to take your clothes off and swim, take clothes off and swim buck naked in the Aegean because it's beautiful water.
Nero was a great swimmer, apparently.
He did swim, yeah. Caesar really sort of gets.
That's right,
Julius Caesar. He at the Battle of Alexandria just around BC time. I should have the date, but I can't off the top of my head. But apparently he was losing, and so he dove off his ship, presumably holding in his mouth a 9-pound chainmetal vest that's sort of like a Kevlar vest today, let's say. And he swam 300 yards, according to the historians, from boat to boat to boat to encourage everybody to, you know, stick with the fight and all that sort of stuff. So Caesar lauded his own swimming accomplishments, and others lauded them too. But, I mean, it's just the fascinating thing to me is that so Rome collapses towards the end of the 5th century A.D., and swimming disappears. It absolutely disappears for 1,000 years, all across Europe, not in Africa, not among Native Americans, not among other people, certainly not in China and Japan, but in Europe it just absolutely disappears. It's the strangest phenomena.
It really is, but I want to go back to Caesar Augustus a minute, because that the aqueduct that he built was 90 miles long.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, the one that fed Pompeii. It's one of the great engineering marvels of all time, and so when you look at Pompeii, which goes out of, you know, basically becomes frozen in time about 70 BC AD. If you look at Pompeii, if you go there, and I did, and my wife and I walked the streets and tried to imagine what it was like. It was a water wonderland, and it was a port city, and it had a lot of businesses to it. But water was everywhere. The baths were everywhere, and the wealthy houses had beautiful water gardens. But then there's the palestra, the big exercise yard, and there's an Olympic-sized pool in the middle of the palestra. People were swimming laps in that pool, just like lap swimmers today, I'm sure. I mean, there's no question about it, because swimming was a necessary military skill.
It's just, but 90 miles.
I know. The aqueduct. Oh, well, that's, you know, the engineering marvel. The Greeks, you know, the Greeks did poetry, they did drama, they did great narratives. And the Romans were engineers. And everywhere the Romans went, they built baths. Every time they found a hot spring, they built a bath around it. as they did at Bath in England, what's now Bath in England, when they finally conquered, when they finally got over there in sufficient numbers to take care of the barbarians, as Caesar always called them.
Oh, man. We're talking today with Howard Means. His book is called Splash, 10,000 Years of Swimming. He'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. And having a lot of fun talking with him. You may have some questions about swimming. Maybe it's history or maybe the current. We get up right up to the current level in his book, too, at 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mila. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mealer, and happy to have with us today Howard Means. He's the author of a new book. It's called Splash, 10,000 Years of Swimming. So, did you compete in school, or do you swim for exercise? What part has swimming played in your life? Join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And you know what? We've got Terry from Menominee Falls online. So let's go to the phones and to Terry. Terry, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes. I just wanted to say, Splash, I heard about, you know, the book and what you're talking about, and that's basically my life. I started swimming in the county pools because I'd get headaches playing baseball in the hot weather. Every day, practically 80% of my days were in Wilson or Jackson Park Pool. Then I was on the swim team at Hamilton High School in Milwaukee. I have lifelong buddies from the swim team, things I learned from being on the team, you know, the self-discipline, camaraderie, pushing through pain. My lifeguard job at the Milwaukee County Pools helped me pay for college and more buddies through that lifeguard program. It was just Splash is me, basically.
Well, Terry, thanks a lot for calling. Howard, have you got a comment on that?
Yeah, me too. It's my. So, are you round shouldered?
Yes, my shoulders are round, and I'm working my acromion process right now.
Yeah, you know the whole drill.
I pinched acromion in my right arm. I want to get back to the Masters. I was in Masters, and that kept me in shape in my adult life. And I have to get my shoulder in shape so I can start.
Yeah, I know. Me too. I'm working on a left shoulder that's been a pain in the neck, but I've been doing it now for 70 years since I swam in a first meet, I guess. So I have sympathy.
Oh, well, Terry, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Let's take
One, he said something that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Because there have been various, back in the 20s and 30s, swimming became very, very popular. And there were all these sociological studies about swimming, and the American Association of something. It's a combination of sports people and psychologists declared it to be the best sport going for development of personal confidence and civic responsibility and various other things. I found it really interesting. John Feinstein, the sports writer who written a lot of wonderful books about basketball and golf.
Yeah.
Told me also, he's a master swimmer. He said he's known a lot of people swimmers, and every swimmer he's known very few swimmers who weren't successful at life. So it's one of those skills that, you know, you're by yourself if you're a competitive swimmer, you're by yourself in a pool, you have nothing else to, you know, you can't hear anything. It's sensory deprivation tank basically. And you're going back and forth and back and forth, and all you have is yourself to motivate you on when you're doing those practices. Same thing when you're older and doing master swimming. You know, it's you talking to yourself and saying, get it done.
Terry, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, man. Ron in La Crosse. We'll go to you. Hi, Ron.
Yeah. Excuse me. I had my phone in the pocket. Yeah, and there is a website called frankanswers.com. He's a retired Lutheran minister, and he mentions in a number of columns that he writes on different topics that years ago, before there was good chlorination and good filtering in indoor pools, the segregated swim lessons required boys to swim in the buff at the YMCA and many public high schools.
And I'm one of them. I mean, it's astounding to think about. I've talked about this with people from my generation. We swam in the buff in all our practices at YMCAs. And then there was one famous moment in 10th grade where we all go into gym class. And they're all just guys. And they say, okay, everybody go down to the locker room, strip naked, and report to the pool deck. So now you've got 45 10-year 10th graders. It's a sort of an embarrassing moment, frankly. But the idea was you had to swim to the other end of the pool before, or you had to take swimming lessons. For those of us who are on swim teams and that sort of thing, it was no problem. But I also think, as embarrassing it was, that it was an important thing to have done, because I'm sure there were lives saved from that. This was an integrated high school. And there are a lot of African-American kids in my school who simply hadn't and were terrified of water. And two guys I knew wouldn't even think about getting in the water. So, you know, they had to take it from step one. But that kind of swimming education saves lives, and it's very important to do. So it was a hideous. By the way, I checked with a female classmate of mine from high school in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. She said, do you have to swim in the buff? And she said, no. We did the same test, but they issued us swimsuits, cotton swimsuits, color coded by size. So, you know, big girls got purple suits and medium girls. Can you imagine? Oh, the horror of it.
Well, you know, I'm a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison as well, and sort of looking back on the history of that, at one point, every freshman student had to take swimming because the campus is right on the shores of this gorgeous lake, Lake Mendota.
Right.
And they were trying to save people from drowning.
Absolutely. And it was really interesting looking back at the sort of history of swimming as you move forward through the 16th and 17th century. Because nobody knew how to even get in the water. And this includes Oxford students and Cambridge students. And Cambridge students were banned from going from swimming in whatever the river is that goes through Cambridge. I forget which one it is now. But they were banned on threat of caning from going in the water because they didn't know how to swim, but they were college students, so of course they knew how to do everything. And they might have had some adult beverage might have played a role in there too, probably. Be my guess, but it's important to do this. And another sidelight on that is that when you look at the histories, when you look at the sort of accounts of travelers, this is when nobody could swim in Europe, basically, but travelers to Africa and travelers among the Native Americans here were always marveling at how well the native population swam in these places. They never unlearned how to swim as Europeans did. But now, actually, the lowest swimming literacy is among African Americans and Native Americans in this country because they've unlearned to swim for all sorts of socioeconomic reasons, access to pools, access to education, that sort of thing. So it's a really interesting double, triple-edged sword. Can you have a triple-edged sword? I don't think so. You could have a triple-edged something, but not that, I guess.
You talked about the revival of swimming in the Western world, and you gave credit to three people, Ben Franklin, Richard Russell, and Lord Byron.
Yes, yeah. I mean, Franklin was sort of the first of those in line chronologically. Franklin was, I guess the term is a polymath. He knew a little bit, he knew a lot about a lot of things, but he was an ardent swimmer. And a captain from his days in Boston, when, you know, and he was, when he was the son of an immigrant, well, he was, I guess, what was his father? He became a candle maker. And Franklin hated the job, and so he would escape to the water at every chance he got and learned to swim by studying a book written by a Frenchman named Thevenot, I think I'm pronouncing it correctly. But when he gets over to England and he's training as an apprentice in a print shop and he's 21 years old, he starts talking about swimming with one of his coworkers. He said, well, I'd love to learn to swim. Oh, Franklin says, no trouble, let me teach you. So he shows this guy how to swim in one or two lessons. And then they're walking along the Thames with some people who are older people who are marveling at the fact that anybody could learn to swim. Anybody could swim because nobody could swim practically in England. And Franklin says, well, let me show you. And he strips naked on the shores of the Thames. He jumps into the water. He swims 3 miles down the river with a current behind him, I should add. And you know, he does all these tricks he's learned out of the book. He rolls over. He acts like a, you know, like a rolling log in the water. If only there had been cell phone videos in those days. Can you imagine Ben Franklin doing this stuff?
It'd
be priceless,
man.
I think. And then the guy named Richard Russell.
Physician, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a physician who comes up with this theory that salt water, ingesting salt water, is the cure for all the diseases of the glands. But for your listening audience, don't ingest any more salt water than you possibly that you can't, that you don't want to do that. But he has this theory, and it becomes very popular, and everybody starts going to the ocean as a result. And places like Margate and Brighton build up around this sort of interest. So there becomes an infrastructure for going into the water. And there was no sense of even how to go into the water, even how to approach a pond or a river before this. And then Lord Byron, who many people probably know, had a club foot. And it turned in foot, and so he wasn't good at land sports. But actually, it turns out that might be an advantage in doing the breaststroke kick. And Byron was one of the great self-promoters of all time, and he was also rich beyond comparison from an uncle of his. And so he becomes an ardent swimmer, and he's a romantic poet, and he writes these poems about his swimming feats and everything. And so it puts the, I think I read in the book, he put the whimsy into waves and panache and panache into pools or something like that. So all of a sudden, there's a popular hero, you know, who swims. And that coincides with all the other things that are moving forward that bring swimming back to the fore in Europe. Hello? Oops. I lost you.
Oh, maybe we lost you.
Okay.
Well,
are you still
let's
there?
Go to John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
I'm still here.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Mr. Mueller, and thank you for taking my call. I taught swimming in the Milwaukee Public Schools for 21 years, and we mostly focused on life saving for oneself and for other swimmers.
Mm-hmm.
One time I met a former student who was in my swimming class in an American furniture store, and he approached me and he started talking. We landed upon the subject of swimming, and he informed me that because he was in my class and had the instruction that he did, that he was not afraid of signing up and taking a rafting trip. He was confident that he could undergo any of the stresses and strains and suitably equipped personally with skills that he could save himself if he was dumped in the river. So I was quite pleased to hear that, and I just heard your guest comment on the water safety aspect of swimming, and I just thought I'd give you a call and inform you of that little anecdote.
Well, thank you very much for that, John. Appreciate it very much. I think we do have Jim and Steven's point. Let's go to Jim. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good afternoon. About 35 years ago, I had the second of two major back surgeries at Abbott Northwestern in Minneapolis, and they had a warm water pool. Mm-hmm. And within about 3 days after the surgery, they took me down to the pool, and I've been swimming regularly ever since at the YMCA for rehabilitation and exercise, which has really given me a pretty good life physically. But with the pandemic, it's been 3 months since I've been in the pool, and now the Y is just reopened, and I'm contemplating whether I want to go back in to the Y and the locker rooms and all of that sort of thing. So that's kind of brings me up to current point.
Yeah. Larry, am I still on?
Yes.
Okay, good. I didn't know if you could still hear me. The last caller's story, there's a wonderful story in the book about a guy named Jeff Farrell, who was one of the fastest swimmers in America in about 1964. And the Olympic trials are coming up, and you have to, you know, qualify for the Olympics. And he's favored to win the 100-meter freestyle, and he has appendicitis 5 days before. Has his appendix cut out, and he shows up on the starting blocks 4 days after it. And he has this huge bandage over his appendix, wrapped in plastic tape. And you imagine how primitive the tape was in 1964. And he dives in and he wins his semifinal, and he goes to the final, and he hits the rope as he's running, that the lane marker is running down, and he finishes third. And so he's not going to get to compete. And one of the guys in the race basically says to him afterwards, "Oh, gee, I hurt my toe. You better take my place." And so he gets to compete, and he gets a gold medal out of the whole thing. But just a great story.
Yeah, it's a, you know, I had my appendix out when I was about 20 years old, and I cannot imagine.
Can you imagine exactly?
Oh my goodness!
And you have a swimmer hero in Wisconsin. I want to mention. Well, actually, he's not from Wisconsin; he's from Michigan, but he started from the Wisconsin side. A guy named Jim Dreyer, who has swum all the Great Lakes.
Yes.
Vertically, in the case of a couple of them, Lake Michigan vertically from top to bottom and across from Milwaukee to the Michigan shore. And there are people out there who just take these huge challenges in the water. But Jim Dreyer's great story is that he almost drowned when he was about 4 years old. He was terrified of the water, and he finally got back in swimming again when he was in his late 20s. And like a lot of people, he overcompensated for his fear, and he started swimming across the Great Lakes, which is, you know, just a ridiculous thing to do. And the last one he swam was Lake Superior, because there's only about a one-week window to swim it, and it's so cold. Yeah. And he finally accomplished that, and then he said, I'll do it another time. And the last time he did it, I know, he towed his own provisions behind him in a boat as he swam.
Amazing story. Well, Ann in Eau Claire has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Glad to be on. Well, I grew up next to a small, deep, very cold lake in northern Minnesota, and we swam 3 or 4 times a day. And in college, I was on a synchronized swimming team for 3 years. And now I'm in my 70s, and my grandchildren and my adult children laugh at me when I do my synchronized swimming tricks, some of which I can still do. So I just wanted to let you know there are lots of ways to enjoy the water.
Right, yeah. And also the interesting thing, you know, females, and I'm not talking because I don't know you, but the subcutaneous fat is a great benefit in cold water swimming. And in every other sport, I think, that I can think of, males have a advantage musculature. But the longer the race gets in the colder water, the more a woman is likely to win because they have natural insulation, the subcutaneous fat, which makes them more buoyant. So there's a woman named Lynn Cox. I don't know if anybody's heard of her is listening. She has done astounding things. I mean, she swum across the Bering Straits. She swum across Tierra del Fuego. She's done things that you can't even imagine doing, and things that Michael Phelps wouldn't even attempt for 6 seconds. So there is this sort of aspect of it that swimming is a sport where women actually have a huge competitive advantage the longer the race is, in the colder the water.
And, you know, I was speaking of women swimmers, I was really intrigued by Annette Kellerman and her story.
Isn't she great? I just love this woman. She basically liberated women from the hideous contraptions of swimming in the hideous Victorian costumes that women were required to swim in, including dresses with lead weights on the bottom of them so the swim costume wouldn't rise above the water and men could see their legs. And Annette Kellerman, who was both a great swimmer and a great showwoman, liberated them from that. She was also declared the most perfectly formed woman in the world by the head of the Harvard Gymnasium. And she's a trip. You really ought to read about her. She's a lot of fun.
Had polio as a kid and swimming to kind of recover from it. And it was an absolutely amazing story.
And the whole thing about swimming is the popularity of swimming. She was one of the people who she would do these performances in New York at the Hippodrome in New York, where she would tight rope out over the top of the stage. And we're talking 60 to 90 feet, and then dive from the tightrope into basically a tub. I mean, this is astounding stuff. Nobody does this kind of thing anymore, but it was hugely popular.
Well, I tell you what, your book is such a delight to read. I'm so glad you wrote it, Howard, and I want to thank you so much. We certainly didn't touch on... There are a lot more things that I wanted to talk with you about, but we are out of time. And I really appreciate you being with us today. I hope you sell a lot of copies of this book.
Thanks, Larry. And thanks to your callers, too. They were great as well.
Yeah, great. I'm sorry we didn't get to everyone. Howard Means is the author, and the book is titled Splash, 10,000 Years of Swimming. A fascinating book, and I hope you have a chance to look at it. You're really going to enjoy it. Well, just looking ahead, Scott Craven is back with us tomorrow to give us an update on what's going on in the world of wildlife. So I hope you can join us for that. That's starting at 11 o'clock. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.